So it's that time of the year where we all exchange gifts. And right now, we are giving our gift to you. It's twofold. One, you get amazing reporting. And two, you get the gift of a really great host. I know I'm modest. What can I say? Anyway, so every week we get on the air and we tell stories that you won't hear anywhere else. But to do that, it takes a lot of money. And the only way we can do it is with your support. In these times that we live in, investigative reporting is more important than ever. We uncover hidden information and hold the powerful accountable. We are the antidote to fake news, a source you can trust. So please, go to revealnews.org/donate or text DONATE to 63735. And thanks for your support. From the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX, this is Reveal. I'm Al Letson. And our holiday gift to you this year is a story we first brought you back in May. That's right, we're re-gifting. It touches on corrupt politicians keeping the public in the dark. Now, don't worry, it has nothing to do with this year's election. In fact, this story takes us back more than 40 years. Consider today's show a trip with the ghosts of investigations past. And it begins with someone who's pretty familiar in our newsroom.
I was at a friend's place,
Okay, I heard a laugh there. What's the laugh? What was going on at the front?
It was also hot. I get smoking a joint.
That is our executive director at CIR, Mr. Robert Rosenthal. Now, everybody calls him Rosie. He's talking to one of our reporters, Michael Corey. Rosie's like, he's like Clark Kent of our newsroom. Mild-mannered, soft-spoken, but you get him talking and you realize there is a whole other side of him, like a secret identity. And today, we're going to tell you his origin story that, conveniently for us, intersects with history. You see, it's 1971, and Rosie is about 6 months into an entry-level job at the New York Times.
And the phone rings, and, you know, we didn't pay any attention, but then I hear his mother's voice saying, Robert, she called me Robert, Robert, it's for you. So I'm going, who knows I'm here?
It was one of the top editors at the Times. He told Rosie, don't come into the newsroom in the morning. Go to room 1111 of the Hilton Hotel.
Don't tell anyone where you're going, and bring enough clothes for at least a month. You know, I was like, what?
So Rosie showed up the next day, and the Times had set up a whole mini newsroom in the middle of this giant hotel, where they figured no one would notice them if they were careful.
You're going to be working on a really incredible story that is top secret. It involves the U.S. government, and it's going to be risky. And I remember saying, risky? Why, it's risky. Well, within a few hours, I was Xeroxing the Pentagon Papers and looking at things that said, you know, top secret for your eyes only.
The Pentagon Papers, a trove of classified documents on the Vietnam War. When the New York Times published them in 1971, set off a chain reaction that helped bring down a president. It also marked a turning point in how many Americans saw their government. This was the moment when people learned that the government lied, and lied on a grand scale. Back when Rosie was 22 years old, he had a front row seat.
That whole experience for me really shaped my career in terms of taking risk and working with great people and understanding the power of the press. And it was fun. It was really fun.
Rosie shares a particular bond with the government insider who leaked the papers, Daniel Ellsberg. The two guys spent more time than probably anyone else on Earth secretly copying the Pentagon Papers, all 7,000 pages. Ellsberg and Rosie have known each other for a while, but they've never sat down and talked in detail about their experience. So we went to Ellsberg's house.
Thank you for doing this.
I'm used to getting filmed here a lot. They don't have such fancy sound equipment.
They ended up talking for hours. Now, one of the things they remembered was how much work it was to just copy the documents. It took Ellsberg a year.
I got very jealous later of these machines, you know, and they collate.
Yeah, not that kind of copy machine. This is old school. Open the big heavy cover, put one page in, close the cover, press start, wait, open cover, repeat, 7,000 times.
Page by page. And finally, it was just too slow, so I would put it in without putting the heavy cover on and wondering what this was going to do to my eyes. You know, I was possibly going to go blind eventually.
I remember the green light, the green ray, thinking, is this going to sterilize me?
Oh, so you had the same concern.
Before Edward Snowden showed us, the NSA could spy on all of us. Before Chelsea Manning exposed hundreds of thousands of secret diplomatic cables, there was Daniel Ellsberg. He's the grandfather, the OG, original gangster whistleblower. History generally remembers Ellsberg as a hero, a champion of free speech. On the other hand, Snowden is in exile in Russia, and Chelsea Manning is in a military prison. So, what's the difference? Well, not as much as you might think. At the time of the leak, all the same things people say about Snowden and Manning now, they're traitors, they're threatening national security, people said about Ellsberg too. He was charged with espionage, and he expected to go to prison. But somehow, he got away with leaking classified government documents. But this isn't just a history lesson. You can draw a straight line from what happened in the 70s to today, and the debate over government secrets, and what happens to the people who expose them. His Reveals, Michael Corey.
Most of us have at least heard of the Pentagon Papers. What I remember from high school is that they were about Vietnam, they got leaked to the press by some guy named Daniel Ellsberg, and it was a big deal. The Pentagon Papers were a thing, then Watergate happened. But if that's what you learned in school, you missed the important part. And that includes me. I never learned it this way, but without the Pentagon Papers, there might be no Watergate, and maybe no Nixon resignation. And that's the story I'm going to tell today. First off, who is this guy Ellsberg?
Well, my early life was spent entirely playing the piano because my mother's ambition for me was that I should become a concert pianist.
That didn't happen. When Ellsberg was 15, his mother and sister were killed in a car crash. He and his father survived, but he wasn't destined to be a pianist. And Ellsberg didn't start out a radical. Like many young Americans in the 1950s, he was deeply patriotic. He graduated from Harvard, did a fellowship in England. Then, in 1954, he ditched the pacifism of his Christian Science parents and joined the military. And he didn't mess around. Ellsberg signed up with the Marines.
I wanted to see if I was up to it. You know, there was a Marine poster that said, "Are you man enough to be a Marine?" And, well, like a lot of people, I wanted to find that out.
Ellsberg was up to it, and he even re-upped and served on a ship during the Suez Crisis. For a while, his life was basically the Marines, Harvard, the Marines, Harvard. Who does that? Finally, he got a PhD in what's called decision theory. It's a dry-sounding corner of academia that asks, how should people make rational choices when confronted with uncertainty? But in 1958, this wasn't a theoretical question. It was a question about nuclear weapons, specifically the big scare of the time. Intercontinental ballistic missiles.
So that was the period of the so-called missile gap, where it was understood that the Soviets would have a large force of ICBMs before we did.
By 1961, Ellsberg had started consulting for the Kennedy administration and was now directly involved in planning America's nuclear war strategy. In this era, that strategy was called First Strike, meaning we launch our nuclear weapons before the other guy does. Suddenly, instead of abstract research, Ellsberg was deeply engrossed in some of the nation's greatest secrets. And he found that in nuclear war, there was plenty of uncertainty. Like, how could the president decide quickly if an incoming attack was a false alarm?
If he waits too long, he won't have anything to respond with. So the incentive to get planes off the ground in particular, and even perhaps to commit missiles, is very strong, and yet there's a possibility of a false alarm. And that could have meant a war being triggered by these warnings on either side.
If that sounds like a movie you've seen, you're right.
I went with my boss, Harry Rowan, to see Dr. Strangelove in the afternoon in D.C. because it was a working problem for us.
If you haven't seen Dr. Strangelove, after you finish listening to this episode, drop whatever you're going to do next and watch it. It's a comedy about nuclear war. Hilarious, right?
If we were to immediately launch an all-out and coordinated attack on all their airfields and missile bases, we'd stand a damn good chance of catching them with their pants down.
In this scene, a rogue commander has launched American planes carrying nuclear bombs, and a general, played by George C. Scott, is arguing that maybe the president should let the planes drop them.
But it is necessary now to make a choice, to choose between two admittedly regrettable but nevertheless distinguishable post-war environments. One where you got 20 million people killed, and the other where you got 150 million people killed.
You're talking about mass murder, General, not war.
Mr. President, I'm not saying we wouldn't get our hair mussed, but I do say no more than 10 to 20 million killed, tops.
And I remember we came out of that movie and we both said, that's a documentary. It was a documentary. Everything in that thing, aside from the laughs, everything could have happened just the way as in the movie. For example, the fact that they had no way to call the planes back once they had given a go order.
Ellsberg wondered if the Joint Chiefs of Staff had ever even totaled up how many people would be killed if the U.S. carried out its first strike plan against the Soviet Union and China. He asked. He figured he'd embarrass them because there was no way they had done that. But as he told me and Rosie, it turned out they had.
So that was a total of 600 million, which was 100 Holocausts. And this was from our first strike. So any fighting with Soviet troops, we carry out this attack first, right away, so, and kill 600 million people.
So you're 30 years old. You're getting access to documents that say top secret, eyes of the president only, and you have this number in your head. At that moment, if you go back to it, what was your reaction?
I remember my reaction very, very well. I thought, this is the most evil plan that has existed in the history of the human species. This is an evil piece of paper. It shouldn't exist.
But Ellsberg knew, better than most people, that this wasn't just a piece of paper. He knew because he wasn't the kind of analyst who stayed in his office. He had visited the airfields and actually touched one of the bombs.
I had seen the planes on alert, 10-minute alert. I'd felt one of the bombs, actually. I remember having to be lying there on a trolley. And it was warm from radioactivity.
Ellsberg says he tried to push the Kennedy administration to make the war plan less rigid, but he didn't really get anywhere.
I don't think I had any effect.
So if he couldn't get Washington's hand off the nuclear hair trigger, the only hope he saw was to keep any small conflict from escalating. And it just so happened there was a small conflict that was about to explode in Vietnam.
So all we can do is help. And we're making it very clear. But I don't agree with those who say we should withdraw.
When we come back, we pick up the story of the Pentagon Papers. Next on Reveal from the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX.
Hey, listeners. Julia B. Chan here, Reveal's digital editor. A couple of weeks ago, we aired an investigation by reporter Trey Bundy that exposed how the Jehovah's Witnesses hide child sexual abuse in their congregations. In that episode, we heard from Debbie McDaniel, a victim of sexual abuse, who told us how the threat of being banished keeps members from reporting that abuse. This is also known as disfellowshipping. At Reveal, we're always trying to find new ways to tell stories. And so along with that episode, we created a virtual reality video that tells Debbie's story in a whole new way. Check it out at revealnews.org/disfellowshipped. You can watch it on your iPhone, Android, or on your desktop. Again, that's revealnews.org/disfellowshipped.
From the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX, this is Reveal. I'm Al Ledson. On August 4th, 1964, panicked telegrams started pouring into the Pentagon. One of the people reading them was Daniel Ellsberg, the focus of our show today. He's the guy who leaked the Pentagon Papers, those classified documents that revealed how the government lied to the American people and Congress about the Vietnam War. Now, back in 1964, Ellsberg hadn't done that yet. He was a war analyst at the Pentagon. It was actually his first day on the job, and those telegram messages were coming from a Navy captain off the coast of Vietnam in the Tonkin Gulf.
The captain said North Vietnamese PT boats, super fast, armed with torpedoes, were firing at him. That's what Ellsberg told reporter Michael Corey and our executive director, Robert Rosie Rosenthal.
One torpedo, four torpedoes. We're taking evasive action, 10 torpedoes. Eventually, 22 torpedoes had been fired. And then, after an hour and a half, a message comes through saying, in effect, hold everything. An overeager sonar man has been mistaking the beat of our ship's propeller against our wake as we take evasive action, as torpedo reports.
So all of this might have been nothing. There might not have been any torpedoes, but you wouldn't know it from what happened next. Reveals Michael Corey picks up the story.
That night, President Lyndon Johnson went on TV to tell the nation that he had ordered airstrikes. And Defense Secretary Robert McNamara briefed reporters in a midnight press conference.
Earlier tonight, the president told the nation the United States would take appropriate action to respond to the unprovoked attacks on U.S. naval vessels by torpedo boats of North Vietnam. I can tell you that some of that action has already taken place. U.S. naval aircraft have already conducted airstrikes against the North Vietnamese bases from which these PT boats have operated.
By the time McNamara made that statement, he already had good reasons to question what had happened. It took him decades, but he would eventually acknowledge the whole attack had never happened in the first place. But on this night, if he had any doubts, he wasn't showing them.
Furthermore, the United States has taken the precaution of moving substantial military reinforcements to Southeast Asia from our Pacific bases. We are also sending reinforcements to the Western Pacific from bases in the United States.
Does that mean ground forces are being put into Vietnam?
No, it does not.
Mr. Secretary,
have it means that we are reinforcing our forces there with such additional forces as we think may be required, and we have placed on alert for a movement such forces as might be necessary.
Could you repeat that first part about no troops in Vietnam?
But this, right here, this was the tipping point that mired America in Vietnam.
Have combat units been moved into North Vietnam.
I should say.
In response to the Tonkin Gulf incident, Congress authorized the president to do whatever was necessary, order bombing raids, send ground troops. Within a year, there were more than 200,000 American troops on the ground. Here's Rosie again.
So as you see this sort of political escalation, and you're inside the Pentagon, and you're aware that this is equivocal at best.
Yeah, and that they're lying about it.
And did you ever think then, I'm trapped here, how do I get the truth out? Did that begin the process?
No, because really not at all on that point.
What happened next changed Daniel Ellsberg in ways that would make him the person who would leak the Pentagon Papers. In 1965, Ellsberg was invited to go to Vietnam as part of a State Department study. Just going to Vietnam sets him apart from a lot of Pentagon colleagues. But this wasn't some junket. This was Ellsberg, the former Marine. He stayed in Vietnam for 2 years, and he did some pretty crazy stuff. He drove around on back roads no one thought were safe. He went out on patrol with combat units. He got shelled, got caught in an ambush. And he learned that much of what war commanders were telling Washington was a lie. The Pentagon was getting inflated body counts of how many soldiers we killed. And there were glowing reports, complete with tables and charts, reporting statistics on patrols that never happened. Ellsberg also talked with the Vietnamese people, saw their fear and rage. Thousands of civilians were dying, hundreds of thousands. American and South Vietnamese soldiers were burning villages, bombing towns, spraying Agent Orange, and stripping the jungle to dust and sticks. Ellsberg tasted the war, and he came home convinced we were never going to win.
The people we were fighting were not going to give up. We weren't going to beat them. They were very good soldiers, and they were fighting in their backyard.
When Ellsberg got back to the United States, it was 1967.
The stated purpose of the demonstration was to again stop the draft.
Back and down, down.
And the news media was full of protesters marching in the streets. Ellsberg didn't know it at the time, but even Secretary of Defense McNamara had concluded Vietnam was a lost cause. McNamara had ordered a secret study about decision-making in Vietnam. It was so secret, even President Johnson didn't know it was happening. This study, which covered the entire history of the conflict, going back to World War II, would later be called the Pentagon Papers. They were looking for researchers who had expertise in Vietnam, so they asked Ellsberg to help write it. He didn't have to plan the war anymore. Now he could write about why it all went wrong.
I was still thinking of this as something that we'd had a right to do and might be doing again somewhere. And obviously we had not been successful. So the question was, what could we learn from our past experience?
While he worked on the study, Ellsberg was still seeing top secret communications about the war. And one day in 1968, he saw a memo from Commanding General William Westmoreland that raised his deepest fears.
I knew there was a possibility of they're using nuclear weapons. It was being discussed in the White House. And I also knew that Westmoreland was asking for a couple hundred thousand more men, basically to invade North Vietnam, which would bring the Chinese in, which would mean nuclear war.
Ellsberg showed the top secret memo to Senator Bobby Kennedy, who was running for president. He didn't think he was out of bounds here. After all, Kennedy had been attorney general for his brother JFK, so clearly he had security clearances. A few days later, a story about the troop request showed up in the New York Times. Someone had leaked it. Ellsberg says it wasn't him, and he doesn't know who it was. But the story blew up, and Democrats in Congress started openly turning against Johnson's war escalation. This got Ellsberg thinking about the power of leaks. Could leaks slow down the war?
My idea was one a day, so that the president would know that somebody with very high access, which I had at that time, was leaking.
He thought that if Johnson did decide to escalate the war again, he probably wouldn't tell the American people how many troops he really wanted.
That's what he had done for 3 years at this point, lied every time about what he was actually sending. This time he would know that somebody who knew what he was doing was going to leak it. And he couldn't do it secretly. That was my idea.
Ellsberg had spent years in the inner circle of government secrets. But now, the patriotic Cold Warrior went rogue.
So, for the first time now, I break my promise, not my oath of office, but my contractual promises not to reveal secrets.
That's important to understand. Secrecy was an article of faith to Ellsberg and everyone he worked with. But he decided now that secrecy wasn't his highest duty.
Every member of Congress, every member of the armed services, every officer in the armed services, and every official in the executive branch takes the same oath. And it's not an oath to the president. And it's not even an oath to secrecy. It's an oath to defend and support the Constitution of the United States against all enemies, foreign and domestic.
So in 1968, a full 3 years before the Pentagon Papers, Ellsberg staged his first real leak. He gave New York Times journalist Neil Sheehan a report claiming that the U.S. had Viet Cong and other communist troops on the run across the country. General Westmoreland had written this report for the White House at the end of the year. Problem is, it was totally wrong. Just a couple of weeks later, the communists suddenly attacked military command posts all over South Vietnam in the Tet Offensive. Not bad for a force that was supposedly all but defeated.
So I leaked Westmoreland's year-end report, top secret eyes only, for the president, saying that we have emptied South Vietnam, you know, of the Viet Cong.
Westmoreland was removed from command the next day. Leaking, it turned out, could work. Though Ellsberg was still running in elite national security circles, he started meeting anti-war activists and even hanging out at peace rallies. He was leading a double life, peace activist and top-secret military researcher.
You've asked, you know, what in my understanding changed. In the summer of 1969, I read the earliest parts of the Pentagon Papers, which I had put off till last on the assumption that they were least relevant. In a way, that part had more effect on me than anything else because it made the effort seem illegitimate from the start.
Now, here's more history I didn't learn in high school. I learned, and maybe you did too, that America got into Vietnam to stop communists in the North from taking over the democratic and independent South Vietnam. We were stopping aggression, right? Well, not exactly. Vietnam had been a French colony before World War II. Then, in 1945, the Vietnamese declare independence. No North, no South, one country. That lasted for about 2 seconds. The French want their former colony back and ask the U.S. for help. But Americans aren't ready to do that. Colonialism's dying. Let it go. But then, in 1949, China falls to the communists. Could Vietnam, just south of the border, be next? Suddenly, the U.S. is ready to help the French and starts pouring in money and supplies.
So when I looked at that and I read that history and I said, this isn't in the American ideals or the spirit. We're against empire. We're against colonialism.
To Ellsberg, that meant the war was illegitimate from the beginning. He believed Americans should never have been there. And that meant all the people killed on both sides were not casualties of war.
The unjustified homicide seemed to me murder. And a process of murder that was still going on. I wasn't interested just in setting the record straight or putting out history or something. I was interested in educating people to the need to stop this war.
Around the same time, Ellsberg learned something else that pushed him into action. The new president, Richard Nixon, wasn't actually going to de-escalate the war. Nixon wanted leverage for peace talks, and he decided a secret expansion of U.S. bombing would be the way to get it. Ellsberg didn't know it at the time, but Nixon was even considering a nuclear attack in Vietnam. Nixon talked about it with his advisor, Henry Kissinger, in a real Dr. Strangelove moment that actually happened. This recording is from 1972, after the Pentagon Papers were leaked, but it gives you a sense of where Nixon's head was at. The tape is super scratchy, but Ellsberg knows it by heart.
Well, no, I'd rather use a nuclear bomb.
I'd use a nuclear bomb. Got that, Henry? Kissinger would say, well, Mr. President, I think that would be just too much. Too much, Henry? That's too big. I just want you to think big, for Christ's sake.
I just want you to think big, Henry, for Christ's sake.
It occurred to Ellsberg that the files in his top secret safe at work, the Pentagon Papers, might be a weapon to use against the war, if he could get them to the public.
I felt, I have here thousands of pages of documentation of murder. Maybe I can convince people that it's still going on. So I asked my friend Tony Russo if he knew where there was a Xerox machine.
Keep in mind, in 1970, a Xerox machine was high-end technology. It wasn't like everyone just had one. But it turned out Tony's girlfriend did have one at her advertising agency.
So we started that night to, I took the papers out from my safe and began copying them. And I did that for most of the next year.
He didn't just copy the papers once. He made a bunch of copies and handed them out to friends to hang on to in case he was ever arrested. He was also showing bits of the papers to historians, think tanks, and pretty soon, reporters. He called his old contact at the New York Times, Neil Sheehan, and told him what he had.
And I didn't think the Times would do it at that point. Neil Sheehan had actually told me in the fall of 70 that he'd been taken off Vietnam affairs.
But if Ellsberg could get him a full copy, Sheehan would try to keep looking into it on the side. Eventually, Sheehan persuaded him to hand over all 7,000 pages.
He kept telling me that. He says, no, they're not interested. This is back burner as far as they're concerned. But I want to keep at it, working at it, so that eventually I'll be able to do something with it.
It turns out the story was definitely not on the back burner. The New York Times was actually putting together a small secret team on the Pentagon Papers. And that's where Rosie Rosenthal gets pulled back into the story. Remember, he was a 22-year-old editorial assistant at the paper when he got that call from a Times editor.
And he said, I want you to come to room 1111 at the Hilton Hotel tomorrow. Don't tell anybody where you're going. And bring enough clothes for a month or more. Whew. And I basically said, who is this? And he said, I'm serious, you know, because I had no idea. That was a strange phone call.
So you stayed at the Hilton?
Yeah, I slept in a room with two huge filing cabinets that had, you know, I slept with the Pentagon Papers.
How many other people were doing what you were doing?
The whole team was probably, when the time it got finished, over 20. There was a tremendous amount of pressure and, you know, a sense that any moment the FBI could come in and grab everything and arrest everybody.
The Times decided to do more than just report about what was in the documents. They wanted people to be able to read the Pentagon Papers for themselves. Back then, the only way to get the documents to the public was to print them, verbatim. And that's what the Times was planning to do. It would look like a wall of black text, almost no ads, for page after page after page. The New York Times was about to air out the dirty laundry of four presidents. And no one knew what would happen.
It was an amazingly elaborate process. They had to set up another room and built a room within the Times to set the type secretly. You know, actually, they didn't want any of the union people to do it, so they took foremen and managers to set the type secretly.
Ellsberg didn't know any of this was happening until he got a call on a Saturday afternoon from a Times editor who wasn't on the project. Ellsberg had shown him part of the study, and the editor was planning on using some of it in a book.
He said, well, that study you told me about, they have the whole study now. I said, oh, really? And he said, they're coming out with it, and the building is locked up. They have private police around here to check everybody who comes in and out because they're afraid of an injunction. I said, oh, really?
This was especially interesting news to Ellsberg because he happened to have a full copy of the papers in his apartment. He usually kept copies spread out in empty apartments with friends he could trust. If the FBI happened to stop by on this day, he'd be caught, red-handed.
So I hang up the phone and I call Neil Sheehan. Neil is not available. So,
do you know who you talked to?
Hmm?
Do you know who you talked to at the Times?
No, I forget. Wait, you?
Spoiler alert. It was Rosie.
I answered the phone at the foreign desk, and it was about 4 o'clock maybe on a Saturday afternoon.
Yeah, right.
The tension in the newsroom was incredible because of
the
paper was coming out and the Bulldog, the early edition. And we were worried still that the feds would come in and stop it. You know, the presses were literally about to start rolling. And I answered the phone, and I hear the voice said, is Neil Sheehan there? I have to speak to him. It's urgent, urgent. I need him. Where is he? And you were, like, intense on the phone. I didn't know who it was. And I said, who is this? And you said, it's Daniel Ellsberg. And I said, well, hold on. And I put my hand over the phone, and I turned to two of the editors right there, and I said, it's some guy.
Was Neil there?
No.
Yeah.
He was back at the Hilton. I said, it's some guy who's really sounds like he has to talk to Sheehan. And he said, his name is Daniel Ellsberg. And the two editors went white in the face, and they looked at each other, and one of them said, it's the source.
The editors waved their arms back at Rosie. Get rid of the guy.
And I said, I don't know. I'll tell him you called. I think I probably said, I don't know where he is, and hung up.
So Neil is not available. So I then pick up the phone and call Howard Zinn, who I was going to see that night, to go see Butch Cassidy in The Sundance Kid for the fourth time or something for me. I had given Howard about 1,000 pages of it and Noam Chomsky about 1,000 as historians, you know, for their interest. They were keeping it under their bed.
And this next part makes you wonder, what was he thinking?
So I said, Howard, I've got to store some more stuff with you. The FBI may come any minute. I said, let me come by your place, and I want to drop something off. So somebody else also had given me a lid of grass.
A lid of grass, that's about an ounce of marijuana.
And I thought, okay, they're going to come, you know, any minute here. So we took the lid of grass there, and I gave Howard the stuff, and then we smoked as much as we could and flushed the rest down the toilet.
Yeah. So while Ellsberg was dodging the FBI in a movie theater, baked and watching Butch Cassidy, the presses were rolling for the Sunday paper.
It's June 13, 1971, and just past midnight, the first edition hits the street. The team at the New York Times is huddled, wondering what comes next. At the White House, President Nixon will wake up to get a briefing he didn't expect.
Okay. Nothing else of interest in the world?
Yes, sir. Very significant, this goddamn New York Times expose of
next on Reveal from the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX.
Hi there, I'm Aaron Sankin, a new reporter here at Reveal. I'm on the digital privacy and cybersecurity beat, and I'm particularly focused on how these issues affect socioeconomically disadvantaged communities. Recently, I looked into how schools around the country have made a major push to put wireless devices into the hands of every student. But this ends up creating problems for those who don't have access to the internet at home. To find out more, check out my latest story at revealnews.org/divide. Again, that's revealnews.org/divide.
From the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX, this is Reveal. I'm Al Letson. It's June 13th, 1971. A team of journalists has been working in secret out of hotel rooms for weeks. It's a Sunday morning, and the Pentagon Papers, a classified history of the Vietnam War, hits newsstands. Americans are about to learn much of what they've been told about the war is a lie. Reveal's Michael Corey takes it from there.
At the New York Times, everyone was waiting for the hammer to drop. Robert Rosie Rosenthal remembers wondering, would the FBI swoop in and confiscate the documents? Would they all get arrested?
Nothing happened that Sunday. I remember being in the Hilton with Neil Sheehan and all the reporters, Sunday New York Times, and nothing was happening. And they were bummed. We were all bummed.
You might expect that at the White House, Nixon was blowing his stack over this. You'd be wrong. Thanks to all those secret recordings Nixon made, we know exactly what he was thinking. Here he is talking on the phone that Sunday to General Alexander Haig. Just a note, there's some salty language in some of these tapes.
Okay. Nothing else of interest in the world?
Yes, sir. Very significant, this goddamn New York Times expose of the most highly classified documents of the war.
Oh, that. I see. I didn't read the story, but... You mean that was leaked out of the Pentagon?
This is a devastating security breach of the greatest magnitude of anything I've seen.
Well, what's being done about it then? I mean, did we know this was coming out?
No, we did not, sir.
I just start right at the top and fire some people. I mean, whatever department it came out of, I'd fire the top guy.
Yes. So, no, he's not happy. But for Nixon, this is more than a little tame. And what he hears next is interesting.
But it's something that it's a mixed bag. It's a tough attack on Kennedy. It shows that the genesis of the war really occurred during '61.
Yeah, that's Clifford. I see.
And it's brutal on President Johnson. They're going to end up in a massive gut fight in the Democratic Party on this thing.
Are they?
See, Nixon kind of likes the idea that the New York Times is giving the Democrats trouble. This next call is from Monday morning after the Times ran another section of the Pentagon Papers. It's Nixon with one of his White House aides.
Hello.
It's Mr. Ehrlichman calling you, sir.
Yeah, okay.
Hello.
Mr. President, the Attorney General's called a couple times about these New York Times stories, and he's advised by his people that unless he puts the Times on notice, he's probably going to waive any right of prosecution against the newspaper. And he is calling now to see if you would approve his putting them on notice before their first edition for tomorrow comes out. I realize there are negatives to this in terms of the vote on the Hill. You mean to prosecute the Times?
Right.
Hell, I wouldn't prosecute the Times. My view is to prosecute the goddamn pricks that gave it to him.
Yeah, if you can find out who that is.
Yeah, I know. I mean, could the Times be prosecuted?
Apparently so.
Wait a minute. Well, could he wait one more day? They have one more day after that. Well, I don't know.
Next, Nixon calls Attorney General John Mitchell. Mitchell wants to put the Times on legal notice that they're violating the law by possessing or publishing the papers. Nixon finally agrees.
Well, look, as far as the Times is concerned, hell, they're our enemies. I think we just ought to do it in any way.
As Rosie told me and Pentagon Papers whistleblower Daniel Ellsberg, the Times was about to learn that they had the White House's full attention.
Monday stories came out and it got some more attention, but it exploded when Attorney General John Mitchell asked the Times not to publish.
How did he ask the Times?
It was in a brief telegram in those days, and I happened to be in the room where all the stuff came in, and it's, you know, the teletype machine, clack, 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 and it was a telex to Punch Sulzberger, a telegram basically requesting ceasing publication because of national security. And that was on Monday. And if you go back and look at the third
day. You saw it? You're the one
that
saw it?
Yeah, I actually saw it. I ripped it off and ran. I happened to be there. And I ran down to the foreign desk.
This set off one of the fiercest debates that has probably ever happened inside a newsroom. Should the time stop? Or should they defy the Attorney General of the United States? They needed to consult with publisher Punch Sulzberger, but at that moment, he was on a plane to London.
And all the editors went up to his office and kept the line open, and I was literally in the room because I had to hold the phone.
Which room?
The publisher's office on the 11th floor of the Times, because they were waiting to see what he would do.
And you were actually there?
Yeah.
Jeez.
In the room. And hearing this incredible discussion around what to do.
Do you remember anything of the discussion?
What I recall was a very intense argument. And I kept sitting there going, I can't believe I'm sitting here. I was 22 years old. And I'm listening.
22?
Listening to everything. Yeah, wow. And it was hot again and intense.
The editors and the paper's lawyers went back and forth. The Attorney General's note said they were violating the Espionage Act. That's serious stuff. Do we have the right to publish classified documents? What good is freedom of the press if we can't do this? Well, what good is freedom of the press if the FBI shuts us down? Are we going to take a financial hit? How much will it cost to fight this? What about our reputation? Is this worth it?
It's the only time I've ever seen a scene that was out of the movies, because they had to stop the, you know, it wasn't clear what would happen, so they literally stopped the presses.
They did stop the presses.
Well, they hadn't started, but they delayed them.
Yeah.
The paper's London bureau chief, Tony Lewis, was on the other end from a phone booth at the airport, waiting to snag the publisher as soon as he got in. And that's where one of the most important decisions in the history of journalism got made, inside a phone booth at Heathrow.
And they were waiting to ask the publisher what he wanted to do, and he said, let's publish.
The editors crowded into an elevator with Rosie to go tell the newsroom. The Times top editor was Abe Rosenthal, who's no relation to Rosie Rosenthal. But Rosie's father, who was a prominent journalism professor, had actually gotten Abe his first newspaper job.
And he's in the elevator, and he turns around, and he looks at me, and he pokes me in the chest, and he goes, don't ever repeat a word you heard tonight to a living person, not even your father. And
wow.
And then he came down into the newsroom, and it was quite dramatic, and he put his hand up and said, we're going to publish, and there was literally a cheer.
On Tuesday, Attorney General John Mitchell was done asking. He went to court and got a temporary restraining order. The Times was now officially banned from publishing the papers until a judge could decide on the case. The Times announced they would abide by the temporary order and stopped publication. But Ellsberg, now very much a wanted man, wasn't done. Nothing in the temporary order said another newspaper couldn't publish the papers, so he leaked them again. This time to the Washington Post. The story led the evening news.
Good evening. The dispute between the government and the press over publication of secret Pentagon documents on the Vietnam War has spread to a second newspaper. The Justice Department late today asked for a federal court order to stop the Washington Post from printing any more information from the documents.
Now the Post was sidelined. So Ellsberg gave a section to the Boston Globe. Another injunction. Next, they popped up in the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. Injunction. Then the LA Times, the night papers, the Christian Science Monitor.
The substance of the Pentagon Papers is virtually lost today in the legal process drama that is rapidly turning into a farce.
The news media was now in full revolt. After enjoining four papers, the Justice Department couldn't keep up. A new one was popping up as soon as they stopped the last one. More than 20 newspapers eventually published portions of the Pentagon Papers. And once the Supreme Court ruled, the formerly top-secret papers, which few had even known existed, were now very public.
Good evening. The Supreme Court said no to the government and yes to the newspapers, voting 6-3 to let the New York Times and the Washington Post...
The latest batch of Pentagon papers shows how deeply the U.S. was involved in Vietnam, even during the Eisenhower administration. For example, by 1958...
One possible way of dealing with all-out Chinese intervention, which was secretly discussed at the time, was with nuclear weapons.
But after the smoke cleared, Ellsberg figured he had failed.
No impact on the war. The war went on.
Right.
It was bigger the next year. The public knew more, and they were even more against the war. But they were already against the war, and that had no effect on Nixon. With the Pentagon Papers alone, nothing.
And that might have been it. Except, remember Nixon's initial reaction to the Pentagon Papers on that first day? How he liked that the leak might make trouble for the Democrats? That was not a fleeting thought. In that first week, while the Times was under the temporary injunction, Nixon takes this idea over the edge. He's trying to deflect as much of the heat as possible to former President Lyndon Johnson. He wants Johnson to hold a press conference about the Pentagon Papers. Johnson isn't interested, and Nixon is getting pretty steamed about it. His chief of staff, H.R. Haldeman, has an idea. Maybe they could blackmail Johnson.
You can blackmail Johnson on this stuff, and it might be worth doing.
Haldeman explains that White House aide Tom Houston thinks there might be copies of classified files that would embarrass Johnson at the Brookings Institution, a Washington think tank.
Now, you remember Houston's plan.
But couldn't we go over? Now, Brookings has no right to have classified
documents. You know, I want it implemented on a thievery basis. Goddamn, get in and get those files. Blow the safe and get it.
Did you catch that? Nixon says he wants Houston's plan implemented on a thievery basis. He's ordering his aides to commit a crime on tape by orchestrating a break-in at Brookings. As it turns out, the break-in Nixon asked for doesn't appear to have ever happened. But this sounds familiar, right? This started in motion a chain reaction.
So that gave birth to the plumbers.
To find out what else I had and stop me from putting it out.
If you don't remember from that history class, the plumbers were a group of former CIA guys and Nixon loyalists who did illegal work for the president. They famously got arrested while trying to bug Democratic headquarters at the Watergate Hotel. But did you ever wonder why they were called the plumbers? Originally, one of their jobs was to stop and start leaks. And leak number one was the Pentagon Papers. Ellsberg didn't know this at the time, of course. He was more worried about preparing for his trial. He figured he'd be spending the rest of his life in prison, and the government was certainly going to try.
A federal grand jury handed down new indictments today in the case of the Pentagon Papers. The charges were against Dr. Daniel Ellsberg and Anthony Russo. The former Defense Department aide could receive a maximum of 115 years in prison and fines up to $120,000.
Ellsberg is a free man today, so he got acquitted, right? Nope. Because the trial never got that far.
In Los Angeles today, federal judge Matt Byrne interrupted testimony at the Pentagon Papers trial with a dramatic announcement. Byrne said he had received a memorandum from the Justice Department stating that two Watergate conspirators, Howard Hunt and Gordon Liddy, had burglarized the offices of Daniel Ellsberg's psychiatrist. ABC's Dick Shoemaker has details.
The judge Matt Byrne read the memo to a shocked courtroom. He said the government didn't know if any information from the files was communicated to the prosecution. He wants to know if Liddy and Hunt worked for the White House at the time of the alleged crime. The defense held a hurried conference, and they said the burden of proof is now on the government to show Ellsberg hasn't been compromised. It's certain there'll be a motion for a mistrial.
I bet you thought Nixon resigned because of Watergate. But that's only sort of true. If the plumbers had only been caught in the Watergate, yeah, some heads would probably have had to roll. But the burglars didn't actually have any evidence that implicated the president. But Nixon knew that if investigators got the plumbers talking, they'd find out about the other illegal operations that the White House had authorized, like the planned burglary at Brookings and the Ellsberg break-in.
And so they had to be paid off to keep them quiet and keep them perjuring themselves in front of a grand jury about what other crimes they knew.
When it comes to Nixon, we all know it was the cover-up, not the crimes, that forced him to resign. And the news media followed every twist and turn as the scandals piled up.
Finally, tonight, a word about the Watergate and other matters. When it was learned today that some of the Watergate conspirators had been involved in illegal actions relating to the Pentagon Papers case, the whole affair took on a new and more sinister air. It began with a comic opera burglary of the Democrats, and then, in the past few days, the focus has shifted from the burglary to the much more important question of a possible cover-up in the White House itself, a possible obstruction of justice. And now, with word that these men with connections to the White House were engaged in other illegal practices, one frightening question must be asked. What else did they do? And what else are we to learn?
The public would learn enough about Nixon to end his presidency. As for Daniel Ellsberg, the espionage case against him ended in a mistrial. Reveal's Michael Corey joins me in the studio along with Robert Rosie Rosenthal. Hey, guys.
Hey.
Hi.
So, Rosie, this was a personal journey for you. I mean, this started off when you were, like, in your 20s. I'm not going to say how old you are now, but it's been a little bit of time.
You could figure it out. Well, I was 22, and for me personally as a journalist, it really showed me from the inside the role of a press in a democracy in terms of challenging power and standing up to it. And also the role of a source who comes forward with information that may be very uncomfortable and even dangerous to publish. And it really informed my entire career.
So Ellsberg never intended to take down Nixon. I mean, his idea was that the Pentagon Papers would end the war. Was he successful in that?
Most historians would say that by the time Nixon resigned, the war was pretty much over for America. We had already withdrawn most of our troops, and we had stopped airstrikes. The big worry was what might happen next.
Right, and at the time that Ellsberg was really releasing the papers, though, his biggest concern was that the U.S. would escalate, potentially invade North Vietnam, and bring in the Chinese, which he feared could lead to a nuclear war.
So what's the legacy of all this?
Well, a lot of what we're seeing today with Edward Snowden, Chelsea Manning, people call them traitors. They say they're threatening national security. People said all of those things about Daniel Ellsberg. The major difference between them is that he got away with it kind of almost by accident. And I think the other legacy has really been that the administration now, the Obama administration, is much more sensitive to these kind of things than previous administrations have been. There's actually been 8 prosecutions at least under the Obama administration for leaks of government information. Before the Obama administration, there had been 3 since World War I, including Daniel Ellsberg and Tony Russo.
You know, another lasting legacy is a cynicism about the role of government and the secrecy of government. And again, go back to that period of time, the Pentagon Papers and Watergate capped a period which had seen the civil rights movement, the assassination of the Kennedys and Martin Luther King, the Weather Underground, the Black Panthers. There was a tremendous turmoil. And this just proved, in a way, the Pentagon Papers, that you couldn't trust the government. And I think that's a lasting legacy that's continued and really helped create a cultural split around whether this was legitimate to release this kind of information or really the government had the right to withhold it.
That's Reveal's Robert Rosie Rosenthal and Michael Corey. Thank you guys for coming in.
Thank you, Al.
Michael Corey was our lead producer and reporter, and the show was edited by Kat Snow. Now, reminder, please, to support our work, go to our website, revealnews.org/donate, or text DONATE to 63735. We really could use your help. And this is the time when I get to tell you about my favorite podcast. So I've got about 20 in rotation, and this one is at the top of the list. It's called How to Be Amazing with Michael Ian Black. I know what you're thinking. It's a podcast all about Al Letson. But no, it is not. This is a podcast where Michael sits down with some of the best writers, entertainers, artists, innovative thinkers, and politicians for these humorous, really thought-provoking conversations. Past guests include Amy Schumer, David Sedaris, and Megan Mullally, just to name a few. So check the show out every other week on iTunes, SoundCloud, Stitcher, and wherever else you get your podcasts. Special thanks to Jeffrey Kimball and Ken Hughes for making sure we got our history right, to Luke Nichter for helping us track down the Nixon audio, and to Robert Thompson at the National Archives. Our sound design team is the Wonder Twins, my man, Jay Breezy, Mr. Jim Briggs, and Claire C. Nope Mullen. Support for Reveal is provided by the Reeve and David Logan Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, and the Ethics and Excellence in Journalism Foundation. Reveal is a co-production of the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX. I'm Al Letson, and remember, there is always more to the story.